Whether you're a polyamateur or polyambitious, polyambiguous or polyam, I really hold your head high. Let your freaky flag fly, 'cause your polyamory should be uncensored.
Hi there, and welcome to Polyamory Uncensored, a podcast where we, your hosts, Lindsay Miller
and Katie Williams,
interview a poly person each episode, and we try to answer the five points of journalism. Who, what, when, where, and why, as it pertains to our poly lives.
Hello, and welcome to episode 87, where we are talking to Kathy about the good, the bad, the ugly, and the just plain complicated truths about our poly lives.
All right, Kathy, so thank you so much for being on. Who are you?
Thank you for having me. Oh my God, I'm going to have an existential crisis just with your first question. So I am Kathy for now, because I'm thinking of changing my name, but I am Kathy. I'm a 35-year-old woman who lives somewhere near London in the UK. I will, because I'm talking to two people who I'm guessing are North American, I will end up adopting your accents by the end of the show, and we're just going to have to not talk about it because it's really embarrassing the way I do that. But I promise you and your listeners that I am British. And I am a white woman. I have dwarfism. I have achondroplasia, which is the most common form of dwarfism. So like the kind of celebrities and stars that you may have seen on screen and stuff mostly have my condition. And I live at home with my two adorable but insufferable children. And yeah, that's me.
Adorable but insufferable. I really enjoy that. How do you identify?
I'm a woman, and I use she, her pronouns. I'm a queer woman, which is something that I have been for a long time, but I only realized this year. And yeah, that's me.
So what does polyamory mean to you?
Polyamory means the idea of having like an infinite amount of love that you can hold, and that can be shared among one person or multiple people. And it can also take shape in lots of different ways as well. And that's kind of how I think about it.
What drew you to polyamory?
So early this year, I started dating somebody. And on the second date, it was going really well. And on the second date, he said, just to let you know, I'm poly. And I didn't even know what poly meant. And so I went home and I Googled, like, what is poly? Literally typed in, what is poly? And then it came up with polyamorous. And then I was like, oh, is that when you, like, date lots of people at the same time? And I had all obviously these kind of, like, narrow-minded views of what polyamory was, because that's all we kind of know in a monogamous culture. And then, you know, I kind of ruminated on it and I did a lot of reading around it and I ordered a couple of books and, you know, I properly like nerded out for a couple of weeks and I talked to a couple of friends who were polyamorous. And what was really striking to me was within my relationship with that person, I was experiencing a level of kind of honesty and communication that felt really, really great and healthy and that I hadn't experienced for quite a long time. And it really, really was attractive to me. So I wanted to continue my relationship with him. And so I did. And originally, like in the beginning, I continued it and I was monogamous. But they didn't have much time available and neither did I. We had other commitments and I didn't see them that much. And I was like, but why am I limiting myself? Because actually, like, he's not limiting himself and it's totally cool if I date other people as well. So let's try it. And then I tried it and then I haven't looked back since.
What, if anything, do you find difficult about polyamory?
I think I don't find this difficult about polyamory. I find sometimes other people's misconceptions about polyamory difficult. I think about polyamory itself, sometimes I can, still being quite new to it, I can actually be a bit exhausted by the social interactions and by the level of of contact and care that you have to obviously keep up with various different people. And because I'm still not used to doing that so much, I haven't got used to the signs always of me being burnt out. So I would say that as well sometimes.
You talked a little bit about sort of being relatively new to poly, but now that you are sort of out in poly, do you look back and say, oh, there were signs, you know, when I was younger?
For sure, like 100%. So I'd only been in two long-term monogamous relationships, and in both of them, I had been unfaithful. And I'd also, beyond that unfaithfulness, I felt kind of, I don't know, trapped almost, not by that person, but like, I don't know, like I felt like confined, that I was confined, and that I wanted to not feel that way, but I didn't know that this was an option for not feeling that way. But yeah.
So along those lines, we asked, like, when did you know you were poly? And then also, when did you, if ever, feel different from other folks?
I think I've always felt different. For sure, I've always felt different. So I was married previously. I kind of figured, like, let me get married and let me have some kids and let me do what society wants of me, like, super quick, and everyone's going to be like, wow, she did it, and she did it even though she's disabled as well, that's amazing, you know, and I'm going to be like, woo, and, you know, it's all going to be great and happy ever after. But I never questioned if that's actually what I want. I just did it because I thought that's what I need to do, that's what I need to do to prove my worth, to prove myself that I can do it. So I definitely always felt different because there was always a part of me that didn't want that. I just quieted that voice, I think. Mm-hmm. Or not necessarily that didn't want that. I'm not saying I didn't want my marriage, but that didn't want it in that particular way. So, but I didn't know I was poly until this year when I came, early this year, when I came to learn about what that was and what that meant, and started practicing the poly lifestyle. And felt very at home in it. That's when I felt confident using that label, I suppose.
Where would you say that you are in your poly journey?
Amateur level. yeah, definitely not a captain or a leader yet. But yeah, definitely amateur, definitely learning a lot. And this might be my naivety talking, I feel like we're always learning about different relationships and different things and stuff. It's just, yeah. But yeah, definitely near the beginning.
And where do you hope to go on your poly journey, or do you have any goals?
I don't really have any goals currently, in the sense that, so I'm a single parent and I have two young kids. And I also have quite a busy job. So my time is really constrained anyway. And I'm practicing a solo poly lifestyle because that is what works for me. I can't imagine enjoying having another adult living in my home or anything like that currently. In the future, yeah, maybe, who knows? But I kind of want to keep that as a possibility and not as an aim, because I really enjoy how things are now, and who knows what will happen in the future.
Totally relate to that. That's I've been divorced now for about 7 years, but my children are now getting to be a little bit older, but definitely, like, I don't see myself moving in with another adult and, you know, having another co-parent. Like, my kids have plenty of parents. Yeah. They don't need more parents.
Yeah.
Having said that,
yeah,
I am moving in to a downstairs flat in a duplex that one of my partners lives in. So we are moving sort of a step in that direction of increased domesticity, but it's still like everybody has their own space, and, you know, she's not going to be the mother, you know, another mother.
Yeah. I think that's how I would want it as well. I love my own space. Like, I can't, I feel like they'd just get under my feet and I'd be like, go away. Mm-hmm. but yeah, we'll see. But that sounds really cool that you're like, you have your own space, but you're still super close to each other.
I am really excited about it.
Yeah, that's really cool. So you both have kids?
No. She has another partner who actually lives across the street who also has a child.
I need to get partners that like live across the street and in my building. I'm missing a trick.
I know, so right? It's amazing. She is totally building the dream poly commune.
Just in little houses nearby one another. Exactly. I love that.
Amazing.
It's the modern.
I can't believe there
version.
Are just so many polyamorous people in such close proximity.
Well, part of it, awesome. I mean, she's really doing it intentionally. And part of it is very much, you know, the luck of, as it happens back in the 80s, I think her father bought the house she lives in now and also another house across the street. And that was kind of how they, you know, kept food on the table for a chunk of her childhood. And now they're reaping the benefits of having these two duplexes and being able to fill them with, you know, chosen family.
Amazing. That's really cool.
It's a really good idea.
Maybe I'm going to change my dream. Maybe that's going to be my dream. My dream future.
So why would you say that you are poly?
Because I kind of answered this in a roundabout way to another question, but because I love being in relation, I love people. I love being in relationships with people, and that's not necessarily even romantic, but I love exploring what people are like, and how we can connect on a level of just myself and that person. And I love that being limitless. I love the possibility. And so while I think I probably could be in a monogamous relationship again and be very happy, or I could be, you know, identifying as polyamorous, but just in a relationship with one person and be very happy, I don't want to feel constrained again as I did before.
Mm-hmm. Why did you agree to be interviewed today?
Because this is all really exciting and I want to talk about it. And I want to speak to more poly people, and your podcast is awesome. And so I was like, yeah, it's cool.
And you reached out to us actually. So I didn't.
Yeah. I was like, hey.
But and yeah, we love that. Thank you.
Actually, we've been getting a lot of people who've reached out to me, which is lovely. I love when that happens.
That's amazing. That's really cool. How do you guys know each other? If I can ask.
We met through the group, right?
Yeah, through the local
local polyamory group.
When Lindsay first announced the idea of the podcast, she asked the local group if, you know, people would reach out if they wanted to be interviewed. And I reached out and said, you know, I've really been thinking about podcasting too, and it sounds really fun. Do you want to co-host? At that point
I had recorded just one, like I said, like on my phone, kind of interviewing myself, going through the questions I would want to ask a guest. And I listened back and I was like, okay, this is fine. It's, you know, it's just literally me asking myself questions and then answering them, which is awkward. It's hella awkward, but you know, like, and I, and then I listened back and I was like, wow, this is not it. This is kind of boring. I mean, granted, I wouldn't be asking myself questions this whole time, but I was like, oh, it's so, and it was really short. And our first episode was really like half an hour long at most. And I was like, wow, I don't know. I feel like I need another person here. And then when Katie reached out, I was like, oh, thank God. Cause honestly, this wouldn't have worked if it was one person. I feel so boring, you know, like I would just feel like, oh, this isn't working. And at the beginning, I even thought, I didn't even have the expectation of having guests on. I just thought I will talk about a topic for half an hour, which I was like, I'm so glad I didn't try to do that because that would be boring as hell. So I was just like, okay, I'm so glad that we get to just talk to people, and it just kind of like generated its own thing. We're bringing guests on. They get to talk about what they want to talk about. And we're here to bounce ideas off and listen and interact and have fun conversations. And it's just, it's been kind of loosey goosey, but really worked out it's been working out.
Yeah.
What's really fun, I think, is we have a lot of really interactive conversations and, you know, different people react differently to each of us. And we react differently to the guests. And so having that liveliness, I think, has been a really fun and more entertaining part of this.
Awesome.
Yeah. All right. Well, we're going to take a quick break and we'll be right back.
Interested in more Polyamory Uncensored content? You're in luck. We just started a blog, polyamoryuncensored.wordpress.com. We're going to be showcasing stuff like episode breakdowns, polyamory and ethical non-monogamy related book reviews, and guest posts from authors like you. If you'd like to be a guest author, contact us at polyamoryuncensored@gmail.com, and you might be able to see your work up on our website. Again, that's polyamoryuncensored.wordpress.com, and we're going to have some fun, new, poly-related content for you. Thanks. See you there.
All right, we are back, and we are talking to Kathy today about disability and how it relates to polyamory. So would you like to tell the listeners a little bit more about you personally and like how disability has affected your life?
Yeah. So as I mentioned at the beginning, I have achondroplasia, which is the most common form of dwarfism. And I was the first person born into my family with dwarfism. So my family had no prior experience of it, but obviously they had heard of it and seen it on TV a little bit and stuff like that. But even when I was born, like 35 years ago, there was still, whilst it was easy for me to have a diagnosis, there was still quite a lot unknown about certain medical things in my future. And so I was raised by two parents who were average height, and they kind of really like, I was raised in a house with a lot of love. They were great parents, and they also modeled a really, really healthy relationship between themselves, which was awesome. I would say that being the first person with my disability in my family, and also I was the only child in my house, I had siblings, but they lived elsewhere, meant that I was sometimes wrapped in cotton wool a bit, because my parents wanted to protect me, and they had the time because I didn't have any siblings in the house, and, you know, all of that. And so I grew up quite sensitive. I've always been very sensitive. And when I was a kid, that was shown in like really awful, like not awful, that's a bad word. I was a child, but really, really strong shyness. I was so, so, so shy. And then when I grew older, I kind of toughened up like a lot in my teenage years. And my sensitivity was kind of like barriered off. And I would do anything to protect it. And I've softened up a bit since then, but it's a gradual process. Anyway, that's kind of me. But yeah, and I have a couple of friends who have dwarfism as well. Like when I was young, my parents used to take me to events where there were other people with conditions like mine or the same as mine at these events. And that was nice to feel kind of like in community with other people. And a couple of those people I've maintained contact with through to now. But yeah, so when I was kind of growing up, I referenced earlier how I did the whole like the monogamous success ladder of like getting married and having kids and having buying a house and all of that as early as I could, because I desperately wanted to prove myself. And I think part of wanting to prove myself for me was rooted in, firstly, me not believing that somebody like me could do that. Mm. And secondly, other people not believing that somebody like me could do that and not seeing it represented either. And so I definitely felt like, okay, right, well, this is my window. This is my one and only chance to be happy, because that's what I thought happiness was. And I went for it. Because you don't see people like me, like, I mean, first of all, you don't see us in monogamous relationships, but you don't see us being poly or being queer or being anything other than existing as our kind of sad, silly selves. you know, that's how you see us in the media and stuff. So, yeah, I think, you know, part of me was just like, well, I've got to change that narrative for myself. So off I go. Let me go and do that. And it's only when I kind of started to, I started therapy and I started doing a lot of healing in myself post the breakdown of my marriage that I started to discover these things about myself that that made me realize why even going down that route was something that just never made me happy. And I think, have you seen the film Encanto?
Yes.
Okay.
Oh, yeah. We've watched it like 3 times now.
Yeah. I've watched it like 20 times. And yeah. Basically, like, I relate it to every part of my life that I can. But the character Louisa, like, she's all strong, right? Mm-hmm. And everyone has this expectation of her to be super, super strong. But what I find really interesting is that she doesn't really challenge that. So actually, what we don't know is whether or not those people would be okay if she just said no, right? Because we don't know that. We don't know if she set down a boundary, they could actually be fine with it.
Right.
And that's kind of like, I relate to that a lot because I just assume that's what everyone wants and they're going to be disappointed if they don't get it. So, and then like, it's really funny because like I had a conversation recently with my mom and we were just sitting on the sofa and I was like, hey, mom, I like people who aren't men as well. And she was like, oh, okay, cool. And I was like, and I date like usually more than one person at a time. And she was like, nice. And that was literally the entire conversation. And I was like, wow, I've built this up for like so long in my head.
Wow.
And now she's like sending me like links to LGBTQ plus like social groups and stuff in my area. So like, she's cool. She's fine.
That's awesome. That's so cool.
But yeah. But it's funny. Like we do sometimes obviously we have good reason to build things up, but sometimes it's just, I think for me, it's me not having been assertive enough in the past to vocalize those boundaries. Anyway, I went off in a tangent there.
That's no, what we do here. Yeah. Yeah. When I came out to my little sister, she was very similarly like, okay, I really don't care. I was like, fair enough. Cool.
I actually told one of my kids today as well. And she was like, oh, why are you telling me? Like, sorry, I thought you'd like to know.
Like, ew, mom, I don't want to think about that.
Yeah, basically, yeah.
Yeah, I think there's a sweet spot of age, right, where like at a certain point, like my kid is 4, she's probably not going to really understand she's just not going to really understand that scope of relationships yet. And we're just very open with her about everything because, again, she's, mm-hmm. she doesn't question it. And then there's an age bracket, I think, where they're like, I really don't care, like kid teenagers, or I don't want to hear about it, don't want to know. And then maybe when they're older, they're, well, I don't know, honestly, who knows, like maybe they're also like, no, I don't want to know. Because my mom actually came out to me, and at one point her now husband was in jail, and they have an open relationship when he's in jail. And I was like, cool, I don't want to hear about it. I was like, you don't have to talk about it. I was like, I know what that is, and I don't know. I don't want to know. I don't care.
I hope you're happy. Yeah, I want happiness for you.
Yeah.
And that is all that I need to
know.
Glad
you guys have an arrangement. Don't want to know anymore. I'm good.
Yeah, I came out to, I was married to a woman when my children were born. So there was never a point of coming out to them as queer. It was really more about them experiencing like, hey, wait a minute, there are other people react to our family and what's going on with that.
Right.
But since my divorce, when I came out as poly, I did feel like I needed to tell my kids pretty early on, because the first person that I started dating had become a friend of the family before the romantic relationship started. And his wife knew my kids in her work context. And I was concerned that the kids might sort of pick up on something. My daughter is super, super observant. And so I didn't want her to ever have the impression that there was a secret that, you know, the spouse didn't know, or that anybody was doing anything unethical. Mm-hmm. So I sort of much earlier than I might otherwise had the conversation with the kids of, hey, so I am dating this person and everybody knows, and it's totally okay with everybody. And mm-hmm. this is what it's called. And the kids are like, okay, do we have to keep talking about this?
Yeah. That's basically my kid. Every time I try and talk about anything deep, she's just like, stop it. Like, literally stop it. And yesterday she said to me, so my kids have dwarfism too. And we were in bed having a heart to heart, which is very rare with her. She's like a teenager, but she's 7. And she said to me, oh, I really wish I didn't have dwarfism. This happens sometimes. And I was like, okay, why? And she said, I just want to be able to use the monkey bars at school.
Aww.
And I was expecting this big, deep answer. And I was like, okay, cool.
You're 7. Yeah.
You know, I'm sorry you can't use the monkey bars.
Yeah.
I'm also jealous that's your biggest problem. But like,
right.
But hey, you're 7. You know, that is your biggest problem.
Yeah. It's your biggest problem.
It's your
7.
Biggest problem, exactly.
Mm-hmm. Even at 4, sometimes she'll say things that are so like deep and like meaningful. And then she says, you know, like something about, you know, Spider-Man. And I'm like, okay, yeah, you're 4. Yep.
It's easy to forget sometimes. Sometimes I feel like I'm with 2 little adults, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Like, whoa.
Absolutely.
How old are your kids?
7 and almost 4.
Yeah.
So definitely still in the very high intensity parenting age range.
Yeah, for sure.
It gets a little bit less intense.
Eventually, right?
Can't wait. Can't wait.
Yeah.
Last night it was like we were, because on Saturday nights they sleep in my bed, and I think we have to stop this now, because last night they spent 2 hours arguing over which way my face should be turned. I was in the middle, and so should I be turning facing one kid or should I be turning facing the other kid?
We don't care if you're comfortable or not, Mom. We just want to have your full attention.
You don't get the autonomy.
I ended up on my back like this. Couldn't look at either of them. Oh my gosh, it was horrible. I have this picture of like these being loving moments, like, oh, cuddle up in bed together. You know, it's so lovely.
But it's an hour of arguing. Yeah.
Well, mine are now 13 and almost 16. And, I have to admit, I miss some of those sort of more snuggly times. They're much less snuggly than they used to be, but it's still sweet, at least occasionally.
But less stressful. Probably. I don't know. Stressful. I honestly don't know. Yeah. So
differently stressful. Yeah, less stressful on a physical level.
Yeah.
More on an emotional level, which is way worse.
Yeah, it's about the same on an emotional level, but less stressful.
Oh, okay, good.
So one question that I wanted to ask you about is like dating, and something that we had discussed in a previous episode with this guy Sammy about racism and dating other poly folks or within the polyamorous community was about like prejudice, bigotry, and like fetishization with him with his race. And I was wondering if you have encountered a lot of that, like prejudice, discrimination, and then obviously I imagine fetishism is a thing too. Like, have you had to go through anything like that?
Yeah, I mean, a bit. I'm gonna start it off by saying that when I was dating monogamously, all of those things were a lot worse.
Oh,
like,
really?
A lot worse.
Okay.
Yeah. Because cis straight guys generally are very courageous in their fetishizing techniques. Let's put it that way.
Sure.
And so, and so when I started dating as a queer woman, and at the moment I don't currently date cis straight guys, so I date like bi men or basically anyone else. I kept connecting with people who, firstly, I connect quite often with people who are also disabled, but maybe in a different way. typically they're neurodiverse, or they could be physically disabled as well. And that kind of is, I don't know, it's nice because it means that there's a shared understanding of where we don't go in this connection. And but I have definitely had a bit of fetishization in the poly realm, because I think there is sometimes a tendency to be like, wow, everyone who's poly is like super unique and cool and edgy in their own way. And her thing, her edgy thing is that she has dwarvism, right? And so like that can kind of be seen as like my personality trait, like my, the thing that that makes me stand out. And so, but I think from like many years of dating cis straight men, I'm very, very good at being able to weed it out.
Mm-hmm.
Very good at being able to read it out. And it's quite clear to me when people, I mean, no shade to anybody that does, but I don't do one night stands and things like that. And that removes a lot of that instantly. But it is quite clear to me when people just kind of want to connect because I'm a personality they haven't explored.
Sure.
Yeah. So we've sort of covered a little bit, I think, of the bold out front ways that some segments of the population can just directly own their fetishizing tendencies. Are there also people who seem more out of ignorance being stupid or rude or, you know, whatever?
Yeah.
Infantilizing. That's the word I'm looking for.
Yeah, I haven't really experienced it that much. I did get that the other day. I connected with this guy who a few weeks ago who also has blue hair. And we were getting on, you know, just chatting in whatever app we were using back and forth. It was all really nice. And then suddenly he goes, hey, so do you know any guys who have your condition, because I really want to role play a fantasy. Ooh. And yeah. And I was like, dude, this is really not cool. It's not cool to ask me, but it's also not cool
to ask.
It's difficult because I don't want to speak for everybody who has dwarfism. Like maybe some people with dwarfism are comfortable being in that scenario. I personally am not. Mm-hmm. Because right. Again, that is seeing the person purely for their condition, which
mm-hmm. yeah,
society does with us anyway. And it doesn't feel nice. So it would never feel nice for me. But yeah, but that's like the most outrageous example. And I would say, I would caveat all of this by saying that the fact that I'm a middle-class white woman really speaks to my privilege in this area, because I think that quite a few people, they know what kind of shit won't fly with me.
Mm-hmm.
And they don't do it.
Yeah,
that's fair.
So yeah. I think I've been lucky in that respect, probably. I don't know.
That's fair.
So one of the other things you had mentioned is kind of like the intersectionality between being queer and having like a visible disability and also polyamorous. How do you think that your experience is maybe different from other folk in those respects?
Yeah, sure. So I think what I thought when I realized that I was queer is I was like, oh, this is great, because most of the people I connect with on a romantic level are also queer. And this puts me more in community with them, which is amazing. And what I kind of quickly learned is that queer spaces can be ableist too, right?
Mm-hmm.
And disabled spaces can be queer phobic. And so, you know, finding spaces that are safe for both parts of my identity can be a challenge sometimes. Not impossible, but a challenge. So that's kind of the biggest thing that I've learned over this past year or so. I don't see that many people on dating apps generally or in dating spaces that have physical disabilities. I don't see as many of them. But I do see a lot of people with invisible disabilities. I'm just gonna address briefly the visible invisible thing, because I don't really like these terms, because firstly, they're a bit ableist themselves because they rely on sight. But secondly, secondly, because you might be able to identify that I have dwarfism, but do you, beyond that, what is your understanding of what my needs are or what my boundaries might be or what my health condition is, or, you know, right? That's all invisible,
right?
It's just that you can see, you can identify that I have dwarfism because you've identified people with dwarfism before and we have similar physical characteristics. But I would argue that much of my disability is also invisible for those reasons. And I think that sometimes when dating as well, people will be like, oh yeah, I know what dwarfism is. And they'll find a kind of comfort in that. And they'll be like, yeah, I can handle this because I know what that is because I've seen it.
Mm.
And it's probably, I wouldn't like to speak for other people, but it's probably similar for people who use a wheelchair. You know, people will be like, yeah, I know what that is. I know what the main struggles are. I can handle that. But actually we all experience our disability so differently and we all express it differently and we all have different challenges to do with that that can only be learned through communicating about them. So, yeah, so I you know, I've experienced that quite a bit in the poly community because poly folk tend to be more woke, in inverted commas. People will be like, oh, yeah, yeah, like, this is totally cool. Like, you're like this, like, you know, cool. We're all diverse here. We're all different. We all stand out from the crowd, blah, blah, blah. And they think they get it. Like, they think they get it. But, or they'll even say, like, hey, like, I had a great aunt who was like you, or I have had a couple of poly folk who have also dated people with dwarfism in the past. I didn't connect with them beyond that initial connection because for me, we are rare enough for that to be a fetish.
Mm-hmm.
So, but that's just a personal boundary. So, yeah. So people are very quick to be like, yeah, I totally get you. I get your existence. Like I can support you in the way that I think you need. So yeah, I'm just quick to be like, yeah, actually, no.
Let's see.
Talked about there it being sometimes difficult to find spaces that are safe for your queer identity and your identity as a person with a disability.
Right.
Would you have any advice for poly communities or people putting on events within the poly community to try to create a space that is going to be more safe and inclusive?
I would say that, so when events are run by anybody that isn't disabled, obviously there are a lot of accessibility issues that people don't consider, far beyond like having a ramp or whatever. There are a lot. And it's not, beyond accessibility being an issue, it's not typically something that you can be in conversation about. So I actually recently attended an event where it was really refreshing because they wrote on the invitation, like, here is a space to tell us or to like open up a dialogue with us about any needs that you have. And then you have a conversation with them. And that's great. Cause again, like, it all comes down to, again, assuming like, okay, well, we might have one wheelchair user, so let us put a ramp and then we've covered off accessibility and we'll say it's accessible on the invitation, right? But like, actually, let's talk to your audience and see what they need and, you know, get a proper gauge for it. And I have been to events that have been very, very inaccessible. And I have a disability that I have a lot of privilege in a lot of ways. You know, I can move around the world much like a non-disabled person in many ways. But I can also see when I'm in spaces that my disabled peers would just not even be able to access.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm often in queer spaces that are like that, basically. And then in terms of like the disability community, so I was thinking when I was saying this earlier, I was thinking back to the events for people with dwarfism that I used to go to and how straight they were and how it was all like wife, husband, two kids, you know, at the event, and everyone was white as well, always at these events. But they were just so straight. And it was like, when I was growing up, going to these events as well, you know, it's like, oh, you're going to kiss a boy at the disco, and which girl is going to kiss which boy, and vice versa and stuff, you know? And it was just, it was always like this. So yeah, like the disability community needs to do a lot more to be LGBTQ plus friendly. Yeah. A lot more.
Yeah, it's funny. My next two points that I had in my notes were accessibility and advice. So that's so funny. We're same wavelength. And pre-pandemic, I hosted a monthly social, and I would always try to think of different ways that I can make it accessible, because we have folks in wheelchairs. And then we also have hard of hearing and deaf folks in the group. To my knowledge, though, again, the group is like based a lot in Facebook. So to my knowledge, we don't have a lot of folks who are sight impaired, but that might be because of the nature of the group not being very accessible to
right.
folks who can't right. use Facebook, right? Of course. But I do know that there are people in the greater community who use readers on Facebook because of sight impairedness. But yeah, it's interesting. I like the idea of asking, you know, people who are potentially going to attend an event, what we could do as like organizers. Mm-hmm. Because it's hard to know until you know, right? Like there were so right. many events that I would, you know, the upstairs of a bar is available. So let's grab it, because this is a good space for having a big group of 30. And then someone being like, so do they have an elevator though? And I'm like, fuck. yeah. So that
how high space. Are the bar stools?
And, like, yeah.
If I
yeah.
can't sit down, mm-hmm. like, yeah.
Totally.
No, totally. I get you.
And yeah, and it wasn't until someone brought it up that I'm like, fuck, yeah, of course. And
of course.
You know, we've also had folks ask if I could make transcripts of the podcast or of the group meetings for folks who are hard of hearing, or could we have an interpreter? And because it's free, because like the group is free and all that, I'm like, well, I could ask someone to volunteer their time and maybe that would be okay. Or we could ask for donations, you know, like all these things that I have to like then think, okay, how could we do this? It could be, and it would be awesome. Like I would love to have a sign language interpreter at every meeting, but then also if that person who's hard of hearing isn't going to be there, would I then be wasting someone's time? You know, it's all this thing. And now we're not meeting in person at all, of course. So luckily I have like a break to be able to figure it all out. 2 year break now, Jesus. But, you know, like all of those things have definitely been on my mind of like, how can we do and be better with the group meetings and with socials?
Think we have to, with anything, we have to accept that accessibility costs.
Mm-hmm.
And so to assume that we can make accessibility measures for free, it's probably not going to happen. There are little things you can do, but like in general, accessibility will cost. And I think, so going back to the whole like opening a dialogue thing, it is tricky because a lot of many disabled people don't like talking about their needs or haven't fully acknowledged them. But I still maintain that I think it's a good route to explore, because we cannot, it's naive to assume that non-disabled people should just go away and learn about accessibility and it would be covered, because there's so much disability in the world,
right?
So and there are so many variants of what accessibility means. And I was actually running an accessibility workshop a couple of days ago, and I was talking about how accessibility is not just about not just for disabled people, it's actually for everybody.
Mm-hmm.
But we don't like to admit it. So like the person with a vulva that's got a really heavy period in an 8-hour meeting needs a toilet,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
The person who has children needs to be able to get back for childcare. The person who gets migraines looking at a TV screen, you know, there's always things that we don't term disabilities or we don't think of as disabilities. Even someone wearing glasses is so normalized that we don't call it a disability, right? But we all have access needs, all of us.
Even if we don't have strong access needs, so much of the universal design principles that make things accessible are just helpful for people.
Right.
you know,
right. having captions are so helpful.
Yeah, I was just going to use that example. My partner and her other partner with a child and their child watched Encanto recently, and she was just like, I couldn't follow all of it because it's so fast. I really want to watch it with the captions on so that I know I'm not missing anything.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh. Captions are just a main, like, are just a staple in our house. We have captions on everything.
I've got serious hearing loss that I haven't investigated because I can't cope without captions.
Yeah,
now.
I can't.
Just like, what?
Especially with accents. Like, I love watching like British procedurals. I sometimes can't understand a fucking word they're saying. I'm like, they're speaking English. I should know. But I remember watching.
I speak this language.
There was like a season 3 episode of Sherlock, and they were drunk and they were talking so fast, and I didn't have captions on because I was at a friend's house watching it. And I was like, I am basically not able to watch this episode. I was like, I can't understand what they're saying. But with like accessibility, when it comes to neurodivergent folks, we had a guest on talking about like neurodivergent issues. And
I was just listening to that episode before we started
really?
This recording.
Yeah,
well, it was really good.
I vaguely remember them talking about things that I totally would never have thought of, like how loud a bar is and how incredibly overwhelming that can be to some people, or
and the lighting as well.
Lighting.
Know? Yeah.
And I was like, I would never think about that until someone tells me. And so, that's so interesting. Like the various different things that you could think about and try to accommodate. And of course, you're never going to get it perfect. You know, like low light might be bad for somebody, high light might be bad for somebody. So it's like, it's so hard to try to accommodate everyone, but to at least try or know.
To at least try to open that out. And
you
know, your audience might be easy. You might just have one person who needs one thing and then it might be fine.
Right.
You never know.
Yeah.
What I really liked about your comment earlier about the invitation to the event that had the sort of please tell us about your needs is that not only are we then not trying to guess what might be helpful based on our perception of people, but it also really gives people the space. Like maybe today someone has the emotional energy to do that education piece. And so they put in a request for whatever kinds of accommodations that they need or that someone in their polycule needs. And, you know, another time, maybe they just don't and they don't want to deal with it. I'm not going to be the ambassador from disability this week. So, you know, and that's fine because it's an open dialogue. And so you can participate in it when you choose to, but there's no obligation. And you can be responsible in some respect for asking for what you need, but not pressured to,
you know,
and then it's on us also, if we're hosting events, to try to think about like, okay, what requests have we gotten in the past? We haven't necessarily gotten those requests now, but we probably ought to keep them in mind anyway.
Just being like, okay, so we can provide low lighting, an elevator, whatever, you know, we can do XXX.
Right.
Is there anything else that you particularly need? So, you know, so that people know the measures that are in place. And so that they also know that if they don't bring that dialogue, they won't get that thing. So, you know, I think that might encourage people even more to be like, actually, yeah, is this possible?
Right. And seeing
That's
that we're doing
idea,
other things.
Sparking people's recognition that we are trying to engage in the community and we want to make this event a place where you feel welcome, but we don't have complete information because we are not you.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
I know it's becoming more common, but it was just, I was just kind of reminded of like at my job, we have a no scent policy. And I feel like that's not new by any means, but I feel like encouraging it for conferences and workplaces and stuff like that. Like, don't wear perfume because it literally will give some people migraines and they cannot You know, like,
it's
such a small thing that most people might not ever think about. They're putting on scented deodorant, shampoo, perfume, and every other thing in the book. And they're just like, it doesn't bother me. So why would it bother anyone else?
Yeah.
and it will like debilitate somebody else, just fully cannot work with you. And it's such a small thing, but it's easy enough to say, like, please don't put on perfume. We don't need it.
Yeah.
And if we're all not doing it, you should be comfortable.
Exactly.
Right. But to go back to the very beginning of our conversation, please shower anyway.
Please shower anyway. Yeah.
That's always welcome. Yes. Coming back to the topic a bit, if you, I know you said you teach classes and you're like an advocate and stuff. Do you have anything you'd want to promote, website, blog, stuff for listeners if they want to hear more about you?
So I have an Instagram, which is Kathy Ray Writes, W-R-I-T-E-S. I should have thought about that before because people always spell the rights part wrong. But yeah, as in I am a writer, so that's my Instagram handle. And I talk a bit about disability justice and stuff on there. I don't describe myself as an activist or an advocate. I describe myself just as a messy, flawed human who who sometimes talks about disability, who sometimes talks about sex, who sometimes talks about all manner of things, my cat and my kids. So I do a bit of work with businesses, a little bit of work with businesses on access. And I do like workshop stuff and panel stuff on disability, sex, relationships, things like that. But yeah, that's me.
Well, we're looking for those kinds of resources. That's on your Instagram?
Yeah.
What do you write about?
So I actually have a main daytime job working for an educational publisher. And so I commission educational materials, but my side hustle is journalism, and I write about sex, dating, queerness, relationships, disability, motherhood.
Cool. Awesome.
Yeah.
I wish I had more time to write. My boss just asked me to write a blog post, and I was like, oh, sure, I'll try.
I kind of love it and hate it. Yeah. But it's cool.
Yeah. We have a blog too, the Polyamory Uncensored blog, and it's been a minute since I've sat down and written a blog post, but I keep looking at it and being like, that's a thing. I should do that. That'd be cool.
Oh, I need to go read it. What do you write about on there? Is it like a personal diary or is it more?
Oh, there are a couple personal. There are a couple of personal blog posts. Like I've written a couple about like, I was a unicorn once in a relationship and how that crashed and burned. And I wrote about that. I wrote about like, people confusing boundaries and rules and how people can sometimes really, abuse the power of boundaries and saying that a boundary is a boundary or a rule is a boundary when it, you know, like I've written about that kind of stuff, common poly mistakes and stuff like that. But then also I just write about sometimes I haven't in like 10 episodes, but sometimes I'll write a blog post about the episode, like my show notes or whatever. I haven't done that in a minute, but I intend to. I intend to catch up one day. I'll be like, this will be my Polyamory Uncensored day, and I'll be writing all my blog posts. But yeah, it's just been, during the pandemic, it's been hard to motivate myself to do anything. Like getting here is like, that's the baseline, and anything above recording and editing the podcast is just like frosting on the cake, right? Where I'm like,
yeah,
I'll do it if I want, but I don't have to, so I might not.
Yeah, anything I don't have to do is super hard for me to do. Something that I really struggle with is like, so since I came out as queer and I've started connecting with a lot of people who aren't, again, cis men, because I have what I deem to be a very small Instagram following, nevertheless, I would say that 90% of people I connect with on dating apps know me from Instagram.
Oh, interesting.
Wow. Yeah. And I've never had that with cis men, obviously, because why would they follow me? Right? They don't care. But like, that's like a curveball I just was not expecting at all. And I'm like, fuck. Genuinely don't know how to deal with this. And I kind of flip-flop between like being like, okay, it's over, I'm shutting this down and freaking out, and then being like, oh, actually it's okay. Yeah, it's weird.
I've had a couple random people on OkCupid know me from the podcast. And then one time, and this was again, this was in like 2019, it was quite a while ago, a waitress at our restaurant. I think, I don't know if she recognized my face because I show my face on Instagram, but not a lot, or my voice or my name. I'm not quite sure what she did, but she was like, "Hey, I know you from online." And she just was very vague about it. I think because she didn't know I was like with my partner. Right. And she was like, and I was like, in what capacity? Because I literally was like, there is so much that you could be referencing so right much. Now. And
she's amazing.
Like she kind of whispered like your podcast. And I was like, oh, really? And then I was like, how did you like, what, that's how did you so know who cool. I was? That's so cool. Yeah. That's I was so like, cool. My waitress at a restaurant in Milwaukee. That's so interesting. And
that
I
is
think,
so funny and random. Cause
you know, I mean, it was so random. Yeah.
Lindsay hasn't really talked about, it hasn't come up in this episode, but Lindsay has some totally not poly related side hustles that she has a lot of community around too. Like she's a fiber artist and our group of people who we know in common on Facebook includes a number of those people. I am not a fiber artist, but like the Venn diagram of mom and fiber artist is very high.
Yeah.
So there are people I know through like my kids' school who also know Lindsay, but not through any of her poly work or her work professionally in her at the store. And so it's sort of an interesting like,
that's so interesting.
Yeah, it's interesting when people are like, I have a mutual friend with you and they're either poly or a knitter and I can't tell. And I'm like, well, you can ask me, I might know, and they might
totally
be both. Yeah.
There was a time like one of the moms that we know in common, I remember having had a little crush on her husband at one point and like, ooh, I wonder, Lindsay.
If she's friends with Lindsay, there's a good chance. But I think that one was just a knitter. I think she was just a knitter.
Yeah. That's amazing. Is there a lot of poly community where you live?
There is. And I think actually that we have to give a lot of the credit to that to Lindsay, who has really been a huge community builder for the last 12 years.
Yeah.
Wow.
12 or 13,
In terms of like really in the before times, having these regular monthly discussion groups and regular monthly socials and making sure they're in different parts of the city or the community. And again, also trying to look at making sure the spaces were accessible, but also not always to the same people. Like it was really, there was a predictable calendar. And also a variety of spaces or topics or things like that. And it's really done an amazing job to create a community.
Yeah, it's now pretty sizable. I mean, I think our Facebook group has like 500 people or 600 people, which is pretty good. Yeah, I would say on average, again, in the before times, we would have a social of 30 to 40 people. It got to the point where we were no longer able to meet like indoors because we were too big, you know, and during the pandemic this past summer, we were able to, right when it was like that low period where there were only a few cases around, you know, in our state, we were able to meet outside safely. And that was amazing. And then winter and, you know, Omicron came and now we don't, we meet on Zoom, but I hope to get back to a place where we can all meet safely outside again every summer. And we're in very North America in Wisconsin. It's very cold for 9 months of the year. It feels like it's so cold here.
Up until this point in the conversation, I was like, I'm moving there, but I can't handle the cold. So
where are
no,
you?
I'm not. I mean, as in
our community sounded so great. We were luring her in.
Yes. Exactly. That's fair. No. Yeah.
You'd only want to visit in the summer, really.
Yeah. Unfortunately, there are definitely places in America where it's not like this. We are in one of the most northern parts of America, and it is rough for quite a few months of the year. Right. Like right now, I would say it was like, it's so sunny out right now, but it is
15 degrees.
Yeah. I don't know. 15, that's Fahrenheit.
Fahrenheit. So
what is it?
That's Fahrenheit. Negative,
but yeah, it's cold as fuck, like most of the time here. So for half of the year, we really can't
My partner and I were just talking this morning when we were walking from her car into urgent care, how we can handle the cold when it's just cold, but when it's also windy and then it's cold enough that it makes your face hurt, that's when it's terrible.
Yeah, it's negative 10 degrees Celsius.
Negative 10. Optimistic.
So is it like snowing or it's not snowing?
It's not sunny. Today. It's beautiful out, but it's just really, really cold. Yeah. And it's supposed to get out.
It's actually a little cold. Like it doesn't usually snow when it gets this cold. It's usually a little bit warmer when it snows.
Yeah, it's supposed to warm up at the end of the week and snow. Like it's going to get to essentially 0 degrees Celsius and then it'll snow and it'll be really nice. Yeah.
Surely that affects your like mobility in your area, right?
Oh, it does. Absolutely. Yeah.
Absolutely. You definitely have to have good traction on your shoes good boots. Like,
and there are totally days in which events have to be canceled because of snow. There are days in which it's so cold that the buses don't run because they'll freeze. Like that's rare, but it does happen. Or where the snowplow can't get out early enough for buses to run on time, you know? So that's always something in the really deep winter when we have to think about. And icy roads, like that's a big deal to consider.
My aunt doesn't leave the house basically when it's this bitter out because a couple of years ago, she got gangrene. She's got diabetes that has affected her feet and she's lost a few toes to that already. And so she has footwear that's very complicated and strange looking and what have you. But it's not available warm enough. Mm-hmm. And so she was outside for a little bit too long and ended up with absolutely severe problems that, you know, truly disabled her as opposed to the challenges that she had previously been living with for probably half a year while she was being treated for the gangrene that had set in by way of frostbite because of being outside in the bitter cold.
Wow.
And something that's really important here in Milwaukee and I think also in Chicago is being sure to shovel when it snows because people who are in a wheelchair cannot move. They are totally immobilized when there's not clear sidewalks. And I know as you know, like someone who helps manage a business, we are very careful about having all of our walkways clear for people who need to use wheelchairs, having the curbs clear of snow so that they can get up onto the sidewalk. And that's something that so many people in the city don't give a shit about. And it's really disheartening because like, it's hard to walk in Milwaukee on most Milwaukee sidewalks, much less ride, you know, like it's so bumpy. As soon as it hits, you know, it'll snow and then it'll immediately freeze and turn into rock solid ice. And it's uneven because somebody has walked their dogs over it already, you know, like, so it gets really bad really fast. So we have to keep constant, like, make sure we have things cleared and make sure they're, again, just accessible. And it's something that you might not, again, if you're not from here, you're not going to think about the sidewalks, but it's really hard for
people. Again, it's another accessibility measure that like literally helps everyone.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Absolutely.
Because no one wants that stuff, or, you know.
Right. Well, and when you think about parents, you know, with taking kids out for a walk.
With little kids or with a dog.
Strollers.
Or, yeah.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
All of those things are just as challenged by the snow being there. And it's really makes a difference to the whole quality of life for the community.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah, so I'm not coming to live there.
Yeah.
Thanks for the offer.
Yeah.
Thanks for the offer.
Maybe skip Wisconsin. Yeah.
Kathy, thank you so much for reaching out and for agreeing to join us today and be interviewed and share your experiences. It was a really interesting conversation. And I think we got some cool ideas for ways that we can try to open up our community and make sure that we're addressing the needs of the people in our community.
Absolutely.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, thank you so much.
All right.
Take care, everybody.
Bye.
And that is it from us at Polyamory Uncensored. We have been Lindsay Miller
and Katie Williams.
We'd like to thank podcast husband Rob for being our sound engineer.
And thank you, Lindsay, for editing this podcast so that we sound smart.
You can follow us on Facebook and Instagram at Polyamory Uncensored.
Contact us at polyamoryuncensored@gmail.com if you have a listener question or a comment.
And if you'd like to support us at all, you can send us a monthly contribution at anchor.fm/polyamoryuncensored and simply click on the Support This Podcast button.
If you'd like to support the podcast with a one-time contribution, we have set up a PayPal link to make it super easy. Thank you for your support in any amount at paypal.me/polyamoryuncensored.
We hope you have enjoyed this episode, and remember,
we love you. Bye.